laughed. I think you have been living with soldiers for too long.
And I think you and I have something to offer each other. You want Hungary.
I want Wallachia.
I will do whatever you need to secure your throne. And once you have it, you will help me to mine.
Matthias raised his eyebrows. Will I? Tell me, why would I want that?
A strong Wallachia means a more secure Hungary. We both know the current prince has given the Sultan rights to move through the country. They walk straight to your borders without so much as a blade to bar their way. If you help me gain Wallachia, I promise no Ottoman army will make it through alive.
Matthias's hand traced the air above his head, lingering on something Larder could not see. Do you know Poland has the crown? They took it for safe keeping. No one can be a legitimate king of Hungary without that crown.
What does that matter?
It is an object. It is a symbol.
Dependence on symbols breeds weakness. If you are king, you do not need a crown.
Hmm. Matthias dropped his hand and looked Larda up and down in a way that made her feel more like livestock than a person. My father has left you in charge while he is on the mend.
How little did Matthias know of his father's condition? Larda was not equipped to break the news gently to him. He should have already been told. Your father will never mend.
Matthias shook his head. No, that will not do. My father is in seclusion for his health, but while he rests, he has entrusted you with his most private concerns and important charges.
Larda caught his meanings like the beginning of a cold.
Yes, she said. He has left me in charge. And he tasked you with rooting out threats to the throne, such as treason.
Treason? Larda had expected to argue with Matthias to convince him of her utility. She had underestimated his willingness to grasp at any advantage.
Yes, it would appear that Auric, the protector of the king and my chief rival, has been committing treason. You and your men will go to his home and find all the evidence you need.
Matthias smiled, teeth stained dark with wine.
And then you will execute him on behalf of my father.
Larda raised an eyebrow.
Without trial? You are Wallachians. Everyone knows how vicious you are.
He watched Larda for her reaction, balking at being asked to commit murder, taking offense at being called vicious. He would get no such reactions from her. She met his look with a hint of a smile. He seemed to think she would dislike her people being spoken of this way. Instead, it filled her with pride. Satisfied with her lack of objections, Matthias continued.
After Auric is dead, the king will need a new protector and regent.
Larda nodded. It was simple enough. And then?
And then the king will succumb to his weaknesses, and the protector will be the most obvious choice for king. A king who can connect you with those who will secure your own throne.
Matthias held out his hand. It hung in the air between them like a chain. The chain was weighted with the deaths of two innocent men. Auric, whom Larda did not know, but whose reputation was one of fairness and morality. And the child king, who had done nothing wrong but be born to power he could not wield. Two deaths, two thrones. Larda took his hand. 29. April 9th. Radu crept into the kitchen, a knife in his hand. The noise that had awakened him in the middle of the night was revealed by a candle, which threw the room into sharp relief. A few golden glows, a multitude of black shadows. One of the glowing points was Cyprian's face, but it did not have its usual light.
What is wrong?
Radu crossed the room to him and felt his forehead, fearing Cyprian was ill. Then he smelled the alcohol, and Cyprian's malady was explained.
Come on.
Radu took Cyprian's elbow to steady him.
You should go to bed. No. No, I cannot sleep. Not now. I fear what dreams will dance before me after tonight's meeting with my uncle.
The withered part of Radu that still hoped to make some difference jolted alert.
Then we should go for a walk. The night air will help sober you.
Cyprian mumbled assent. Radu found the other man's cloak discarded on the floor and helped Cyprian fasten it. Cyprian stayed close to Radu, one hand on his shoulder. The weight of it suggested Cyprian could not quite stay upright without Radu's support.
What about Nazira? She will not miss me.
Radu opened the door and helped Cyprian navigate the short distance to the street. They walked in silence for some time, Cyprian leaning against Radu for support. The night was bitterly cold and as still as the grave.
You love Nazira, Cyprian said. Yes, like a sister.
Radu stopped, causing Cyprian to stumble. Radu forced a quiet laugh.
You have never met my sister, if you think I could ever adore her as I do Nazira.
Cyprian gestured emphatically.
But there is no passion.
Radu began walking again, his mind whirling. Cyprian saw too much. They should never have agreed to live with him. If someone suspected Nazira was anything other than his beloved wife, they were in more danger than ever. She had come to sell his story beyond doubt, but if people doubted the marriage itself...
She is my wife, and my concern. And now you are my concern, too. What is wrong? I have never seen you like this.
In the weeks that they had known him, Cyprian had never been drunk. Even when he had learned of the deaths of his fellow ambassadors, he had remained focused and collected in his grief. Something must have happened tonight to affect such a change.
8,000,
Cyprian said, his voice a whisper.
8,000 what?
8,000 men.
That is all we have.
Radu paused, causing Cyprian to stumble again. Radu caught him and held his arms.
8,000.
That was fewer than Radu had suspected. He had seen how bleak the city was, but not even that was enough to indicate just how few men they had to call on.
8,000 men. For 12 miles of wall. 8,000 men against 60,000. But surely more help will come.
Cyprian shook his head, listening to the side with the movement.
My uncle holds out hope. But I have none. The Turks are already here. You told us they have a navy on the way. Who will send aid? How will they get here? Who will look at the hordes at our gates and dare stand with us? But you heard Giestiniani on the walls. You are still fighting from a place of strength.
Radu did not know whether he was trying to press Cyprian for more details on the city's defences, or to comfort him.
You were able to repel that attack yesterday.
Mahmed had sent a small force against one of the weaker sections of the wall. It was a sudden, ferocious attack, but after a couple of hours, 200 Ottomans were dead, and only a handful of defenders had been lost. It was a huge victory for Giestiniani. Evidence that his claims of being able to defend the city had some weight. Or at least that was what was being said. Radu suspected that Mahmed had been playing like a cat with its prey, because what no one knew, what they did not take into account, was that throwing men at the walls was not how Mahmed meant to break them. The cannons had not arrived yet. Until then, he was content to batter the walls and watch the mice scramble. Radu saw a familiar building in front of them. He steered Cyprian toward the Hagia Sophia and propped him against the wall while he picked the lock. The door clicked open. Radu grabbed Cyprian and pushed him into the church. Cyprian stumbled, looking up at the ceiling instead of at his feet.
Why are we here? Because it is quiet. Have you come here before? You picked that lock very easily.
Radu smiled because Cyprian could not see it in the dark.
It took me forever to pick the lock. You are too drunk to remember. You fell asleep in the middle. I did not.
Laughing, Radu guided Cyprian toward a corner, where the drunk man slid down against the wall and leaned his head back. Radu sat next to him, mimicking his posture.
I am so sorry,
Cyprian said.
For what? For bringing you here. I condemned you to death. I should have... I thought of taking us somewhere else. To Cyprus. I should have talked you out of this madness. Now you are trapped here, and it is all my fault.
Radu put a hand on Cyprian's arm, hating the anguish in his friend's voice. No, not his friend. He could not view him as a friend. Would not. He quickly pulled his hand back.
You saved us from Mehmed. Do not apologize for that. We came because we wanted to help the city. We would not have accepted running and hiding, just as you could not bring yourself to do it.
You call him Mehmed.
Radu turned towards Cyprian, but the other man was staring straight ahead into the darkness. Radu could not make out his expression.
What do you mean?
He asked, his voice careful.
The Sultan. You try not to, but when you are not being careful, you call him Mehmed. You were close to him.
Radu searched the shadows around them for the right way to answer. Cyprian spoke before he could, though.
It was not all bad, was it? Being with him?
Now Radu was fully alert. Could Cyprian's drunkenness have been an act to lull Radu into security? To get him to reveal something he should not? Was this a follow-up to the prying questions about Radu's relationship with Nazira? He chose his words with as much care as he had ever given anything.
The Sultan was kind to me when we were boys. I looked up to him. I thought he had saved me from the pain we endured from his father's tutors. He was all I had. Your sister was with you, though.
Radu laughed dryly.
Again, you have never met my sister. She responded to our torments by getting harder, crueler, further away. It made her stronger, but it was breaking me. So when Mehmed, the Sultan, offered me kindness, it was like someone had offered me the sun in the midst of the longest, coldest winter of my life.
Radu cleared his throat. He walked as close to the truth as he could, so that his lies would be masked in sincerity.
But as we grew older, he became different, more focused, more determined. The friend and protector I thought I had was not mine at all, and never had been. I valued him above everything else, and he... Well, everything in the Empire belongs to him, and he uses people as he sees fit.
Radu knew Cyprian would think he was referring to being part of a male harem. But the sadness in his voice was not hard to place there. Mehmed had used him, sent him away on a fool's errand. He would rather have been a shameful secret than a banished one.
But did you love him?
Radu stared hard at Cyprian. Cyprian, in turn, stared only at the frigid marble tiles beneath them, tracing his finger along a seam. The question sounded oddly earnest, not as though he were teasing or trying to provoke Radu. Radu stood.
It does not matter, because I betrayed him. He never forgives betrayal.
Radu held out his hand and Cyprian took it. He pulled Cyprian heavily to his feet, and they both lost their balance and stumbled. Cyprian held on to his collar, his face against Radu's shoulder.
I would forgive you, he whispered.
There was a moment between several breaths where Radu thought, maybe, perhaps. Then Cyprian bent over, hands on his stomach, and ran for the door. Radu followed, then wished he had not, as Cyprian vomited into the street just outside the Hagia Sophia. Confused and cold, Radu closed and locked the door behind them. I would forgive you, echoed in his brain, sticking where it should not. Would he really, if he knew? Radu turned to help Cyprian, whose wretched retching noises were the only sound in the dark. A movement caught his eye. Across the street, in the shadows of a pillar, stood a boy. Radu peered through the darkness and then inhaled sharply with surprise. It was Amal, the servant who had spied for him while Murad died. The servant who had raced through the empire to bring word to Mahmed so he could claim the throne before it was taken from him. The servant who had most definitely been in the palace at Adirna when Radu left. The boy smiled at Radu. Checking to make sure Cyprian was otherwise distracted, Radu hurried across the street. He whispered troop locations, numbers, and any other details he could recall that Amal would be able to remember, to take to Mahmed. His Mahmed. Then Radu went back to Cyprian and helped the other man home, his burden lifted by excitement and hope. Radu paced, the candle in his hand throwing his shadow on the wall behind him. Nazira sat on the bed.
He did have a plan for us. That was why he told me to visit the Hagia Sophia. He always meant to send a scout to find us there. Amal is the perfect choice. The passage between Galata and Constantinople is open during the day. He can easily slip back and forth, meeting Mahmed's men beyond Galata and carrying information. Oh, Nazira, he did have a plan for us.
Radu finally sat, overcome with exhaustion and relief. Nazira got off the bed and knelt in front of him, placing the candle on a table and taking Radu's hands in her own.
Of course he had a plan for us. Did you really think he sent us here for nothing?
I feared it. I thought he wanted me gone. I was so scared. I thought I had risked your life without any purpose.
She tutted.
I would never do anything so foolish. And I would never accuse Mahmed of being wasteful with resources. Of course he would not fail to take advantage of you. We will have to be careful with Amal and not put him in any danger. But it is a good method.
Before Radu could stop himself, tears streamed down his face. He and Nazira would be useful. They would help Mahmed, and Mahmed would know and be glad.
He did not abandon me,
Radu said, lowering his head onto Nazira's shoulder.
I can still help him.
Nazira patted his back, then lifted his chin so he looked her in the eyes.
We can help the Empire. That is why we are here. To fulfill the words of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and to secure stability for our people. We fight for our brothers and sisters, for their safety. Do not lose sight of that. We are not here as a favor to Mahmed.
She paused, her voice getting softer but cutting deeper.
He will not love you for what you do here.
Radu jerked back from her words.
Do not speak to me of it.
You carry too much hope, and it will canker in your soul like an infection. Serve Mahmed because through serving him, you serve the Empire. But do not do it out of some desperate hope that it will make him love you the way you love him. He cannot.
You do not know him.
Nazira raised an eyebrow. Radu lowered his voice, hissing instead of shouting.
You do not know him. Besides, I do not wish anything more from him than his friendship.
You are welcome to lie to me, but please, stop lying to yourself. Whatever your hopes are with him, I promise they will never be realized.
You have found love.
Yes, with someone who could return it. But you refuse to let go of this festering love for a man who is incapable of loving you.
Radu blinked back tears.
Do I not deserve love?
She put her hand on Radu's cheek. Sweet Radu. You deserve the greatest love the world has ever seen. I simply do not think Mahmed is capable of loving anyone the way you love him.
He loves Lada.
I have met your sister, and I have met Mahmed. They love themselves and their ambition above all else. They love what feeds their ambition, and when it stops feeding that, the love will turn to hate, with more passion than either could ever love with. You love with all your heart, Radu, and deserve someone who can answer that with all of theirs. Radu's buoyant happiness was now a leaden weight, dragging his soul lower than it had ever been. But Mahmud is all I have ever wanted. He is the greatest man in the world.
I agree. He will be the greatest leader our people have ever seen. And he will do great things. He is more than a man, which also makes him less. He has nothing to offer you.
Radu stood pushing past Nazira. He felt hemmed in on every side, claustrophobic and desperate for air.
It does not matter anyway. I cannot have the love I want under any religion. It is wrong.
Nazira grabbed his arm, spinning him around to face her. She was livid.
Do you think my love of Fatima is wrong?
He held up his hands.
No, no.
God encompasses more than any of us realize. The peace I feel in prayer is the same I feel when I am alone with Fatima. The clarity of fasting is the same I have when we work side by side. When I am with Fatima, what I feel is pure and good. I cannot imagine a God who hates anything that is love, any way we find to take tender care of each other. I want you to find that same love, and I never want you to hate yourself for any love that is in you. She pulled him close, and he let her, wondering if it was possible for him to ever have the clarity and purity of love that she had. Knowing that with Mahmud, it was not possible. But how could he let go of the man written onto his very soul?
Mid-April. They spread through the manor like fire. Servants awoke to the sounds of crashing furniture and breaking glass. Some tried to fight. Lada had instructed her men to kill no one. It was not difficult to subdue half-asleep, unarmed people. By the time they reached Ulrich's bedchambers, he had dressed and was waiting for them. His back was straight, his shoulders broad, his face impassive. There was no one else in the bedchamber. Lada was grateful his wife was not there to weep and beg, to bear witness. It was cleaner this way. Ulrich had a sword sheathed at his side. He made no effort to draw the weapon.
"What is the meaning of this?" he asked, voice calm and assured.
Lada knew his fate already. She did not wish to engage with him. With no witnesses, she did not have to play act and accuse him of things they both knew he had not done. Watching him greet his end with such stoic resolve filled her with a measure of shame. He was a strong man, possibly even a great one, according to Stefan's information. So she said nothing. She walked past him, drawing the letter from Mahmud out of her vest. The seal was still intact, his elaborate signature unmistakable. She took tongs and pulled a coal from the fire. With a small thrill of vindictive pleasure, she burned away her own name and the poetry Mahmud had written with his false fingers. When she was finished, the only things that could be seen were Mahmed's signature and his promise to meet in Transylvania with a gift of men. She held out the letter to Nikolai. "We found him trying to burn this." Nikolai took it, an uneasy look shadowing his face. She had not told her men everything, merely that they were raiding the house on behalf of Matthias and Hunyadi. This alliance had been Nikolai's idea, after all. He had no right to question where the road he had set them on would lead. Lada turned back to Ulrich. Now, at last, emotion shaped his warm brown eyes. But he did not look angry or afraid as she had expected. He looked sad.
"He could be an excellent king, you know."
Lada wondered why Ulrich was talking about Matthias. But then Ulrich continued.
"He is a good child. Smart. With a genuine kindness to his soul that is uncommon in anyone. Much less royalty. If he is allowed to grow long enough to reach manhood, he will be a fair and just king. The type of king Hungary needs and deserves."
I am sorry. And to her surprise, Larda was sorry. She had been so focused on getting Matthias's bidding done, she had not stopped to think how it would feel. Securing the throne of Hungary for someone else was not so simple as she had imagined. She shook her head. But I cannot put the needs of Hungary over the needs of Wallachia. The tears that pooled in Ulrich's eyes caught the light of the fire. He lowered his head, whispering a prayer. Then he held out his arms to either side. Remember that he is a child. Give him a gentle death. Larda's knife paused. She looked down at it as it trembled in her hand. This was the first time she would kill a man outside of battle. It was not a reaction to save her own life. It was a choice. She could let Ulrich, a good man, live. He would take this attack as proof of Matthias's treachery and use it to drive him out of the castle. The young king could grow into a man shaped by the strength of his genuine protector. Larda looked up into Bogdan's face. The face of her childhood. It held no judgment. He simply watched her, waiting. The locket around her neck pressed heavy against her heart. Wallachia. She took a deep breath when she plunged the knife into Ulrich's heart. Her hand was steady. The evidence was enough to justify Ulrich's death with only moderate outcry, and since Elizabeth had chosen him as the king's protector, her decisions were suspect as well. She was removed to a far distant castle to be kept there in seclusion. Matthias was named regent and heir, should the king die without issue. Larda did not doubt that would be the case, and sooner rather than later. When she watched Matthias put a hand on the trembling child's shoulder, Larda remembered Ulrich's request. "Kill him gently," she said when Matthias met her in a quiet hall of the castle that would be his. Larda hated Hunedoara, hated this castle, hated her ally. She needed to be free of Hungary. Matthias laughed.
"Are you giving me commands now?"
It was Ulrich's last request.
"I will do as I see fit."
He handed her a letter, sealed with his coat of arms, in which a raven figured prominently. That morning, Larda had seen a raven pull a pigeon from its own nest in the castle eaves, tearing it apart methodically and efficiently.
"This is an introduction to Toma Bazarab. He will instruct and help you on your way to the throne. No one knows the Wallachian boyars better than Toma."
"And men?" Matthias shook his head.
"I have no men better than the ones you already possess. And besides, I cannot part with any. If my men were to accompany you and you failed, it would destroy relations between Hungary and Wallachia."
Larda smiled tightly. "So regardless of whether I win or if I die, you still have an ally on the throne." Matthias was born to this. The young king might have a core of kindness, but Matthias knew what it took to gain and keep power.
"You understand perfectly," he said. "I do hope you succeed, Larda Dracul. I am very curious to see what you can do. I look forward to a long and fruitful relationship."
Larda wanted no such thing from him, but he had given her another knife, and she would use it to cut her way to the throne. She inclined her head, unwilling to bow or curtsy. "I will pay my respects to your father before I leave." Matthias's expression turned briefly wistful before resuming its usual sharpness.
"He is dead. His final act was rooting out the traitor Ulrich. I do not expect you to stay for the funeral."
Larda flinched. She had betrayed Hunyadi to his downfall, and then she had falsely betrayed a good man in his name. This was the thanks she gave Hunyadi for his love, for his trust, for his support. She clutched the locket around her neck so tightly her knuckles went white, drained of blood.
"You are a strange girl," Matthias said fondly.
I am a dragon, she answered. Then she turned and left the toxic castle for what she hoped was the last time. 31. April 12th to the 19th. As Radu and Azira prayed in their room in the pre-dawn light, the end of the world began. They felt the rumblings beneath their knees, cutting off their prayer. The church bells began pealing with all the urgency of angels ushering in the end of times. Radu heard screaming in the streets. The cannons, he turned to Azira. The cannons are here.
Go,
she said. Radu yanked on his boots, nearly falling over in his haste. Before he had finished fastening his cloak, there was pounding on the bedroom door. Radu opened it to find Cyprian as pale and worn as the limestone walls. The cannons, he said, shaking his head. We are finished. We must go to the walls. Radu grabbed Cyprian's arm and turned him around. Have you been yet? What has fallen? Are the Ottomans in the city? I do not know what has happened since I left. I was with my uncle and Giestiniani. They have requested you. I think they finally believe your account of the Turks' guns. Radu almost laughed as they raced out of Cyprian's home and through the streets. They had to push past several mobs that had gathered outside churches, everyone trying to press in at the same time. Concussive blasts shook the whole city, bursts that punctuated the still-clanging bells and the desperate wailing. You, Cyprian grabbed a monk by the collar. The man looked at Cyprian as though he were the devil himself. Where are you going? To the church. You will do no good there. The monk's conviction that Cyprian was the devil solidified. He glared aghast. That is the only place we can do any good. Gather citizens. Have them haul stones and material to the walls. We will need everyone's help if we are to survive the night. You can pray while you work. The monk hesitated but nodded at last. I will spread the word. That was good, Radu said as they continued their sprint toward the walls. It will not be enough. Promise me that if they get through, you will run. I must get Nazira first. Cyprian nodded. Go to Galata if you can. You may be able to slip out undetected. What about you? I will stay with my uncle. Radu stopped. The walls were in sight. They could see plumes of smoke and the dust of shattered stone hanging in the air like a vision of the future. You do not owe this city your life. It is not even your city. Cyprian stopped too, and they stood side by side, chests heaving from their run. My uncle has shown me every kindness, and you should be and are grateful. But if it comes to staying and dying or running and living, choose the latter. He would want that for you. Would he? If he does not, he should. The city will stand or fall depending on the whims of fate. It would be a tragedy if you fell with it. Radu realized as he said it how true it was. He could not bear the thought of Cyprian dying with the city. Cyprian's grey eyes shifted from troubled to thoughtful. Then his smile, the one that nearly shut his eyes with its exuberance, the one Radu had not seen in some time, erased everything else. Cyprian shook his head as though trying to physically shift the smile into a more appropriate expression. But it lingered. Thank you, he said. Radu had never really noticed Cyprian's mouth before, but for some reason he could not look away from it now. With all the clanging and shouting, Radu was disoriented. His head felt light and his heart was beating far faster than the run here should have made it. The sound of a stone ball smashing against a stone wall shook him out of his stupor. Cyprian guided Radu through the chaos to where the Emperor and Giestiniani waited. They stood beneath a tower, gesturing emphatically. The barrel of a very large cannon stuck out at the tower, pointed toward the Ottoman troops. No! Radu shouted, sprinting toward them. A cracking noise rendered him momentarily deaf. As though it were happening from a very great distance, he watched the unanchored force of the cannon shoot it backward. The heat and movement of the blast were too much for the gun. As it hit the back of the tower with shattering force, both gun and tower exploded. Radu turned and tackled Cyprian to the ground beneath them, covering his head as rubble rained down on them. Something slammed into his shoulder. When only a fine shower of dust was left falling around them, Radu rolled off Cyprian, clutching his shoulder. "Are you hurt?" Cyprian leaned over him, searching him for a wound.
"Look for the Emperor. He was closer."
Cyprian stood, dodging around the remains of the tower.
"Uncle?
Uncle!"
With a pained groan, Radu pushed himself up to a seated position. The tower was gone. Only its stone base was left. Several broken bodies were half buried in the rubble.
"Over here!"
Cyprian shouted. Radu grimaced as he tried to stand. Cyprian must have found the Emperor, or his body. Radu knew he should feel relief or even joy that the Emperor had been killed this soon, and by his own men's folly no less. But it made him sad.
"Oh!" he exclaimed, looking up in wonder as Constantine held out a hand to help him stand.
"I thought you were so close to the tower. Giestiniani heard your shout and we jumped free. How did you know it would come down?"
Constantine looked toward the remains with murder written on his face.
"Is my weapons master a traitor? Did he sabotage us?"
Radu grabbed his shoulder as though that could ease the pain pounding through him.
"Not a traitor. Simply a fool. You cannot fire a cannon that large without padding all around it. The force of the blast pushes it backward. He packed too much gunpowder, too. I told you I knew of the Sultan's guns. Urbana, the engineer who made them, was from Transylvania. She was my friend. We spoke often."
"Let me see," Cyprian said.
He turned Radu around and gently peeled Radu's shirt free from his injured shoulder. His fingers were as light as a promise where they traced Radu's skin. Radu shivered.
"You are not bleeding. There will be a lot of bruising. But if you can still move your shoulder, it is probably not broken."
Cyprian's fingers lingered for a few infinite seconds longer. Then he replaced Radu's shirt. That sense of breathlessness was back. Giestiniani cleared his throat, spitting. He had so much stone dust in his hair, he looked as though he had aged 30 years. He considered Radu thoughtfully.
"Are you an expert in cannons, then?" "Not an expert, but none of these towers are equipped for cannons. They are not strong enough, and there is not enough room to support the guns. You will have to figure out another way to use them." "We thought if we could fire back at the Sultan's cannons, we could..." "Too small a target. By the time you used enough shots to get the range right, they would move their guns. You have seen their camp. If you manage to destroy even one cannon, they have the means to repair and cast new cannons. I am certain Obana will be with them. No one is better than she. And I am guessing they have dug in and are firing from behind a bulwark."
Constantine nodded grimly.
"That first shot at the St. Romanus Gate, even I thought the world was ending. But it has not been repeated. Maybe the cannon broke."
Radu tested his shoulder. He could move it, but the pain was excruciating.
"The basilica."
He almost smiled, thinking how delighted Urbana would be.
"It has to cool between firing, so it's limited to several shots a day. It was more to prove they could than for any practical use. It is the number of guns you should fear, not the size of one. Are the walls holding?"
Giestiniani shook some of the grit from his hair.
"So far there are no holes big enough to threaten us. They fire wrong. They should fire in sets of three, one on each side, and then one in the middle, to bring a whole section down. Instead, they fire at the same spot over and over again. They are doing damage, but not enough."
Giestiniani leaned out, watching without flinching as a massive ball shattered against the wall some ways down from them. The sound was louder than any Radu had ever heard, like thunder smashing against thunder.
"We cannot absorb these blows. The fragments from the wall are as likely to kill our men as the cannon shot itself."
Giestiniani was silent for a while, deep in thought.
"We cannot answer their cannons, nor can we trust the strength of the walls."
He smiled grimly.
"It is time to become more flexible."
Because of Radu's shoulder injury, he helped Cyprian with organizing rather than going to fix the walls. All day they ran, directing men to dump mortar paste down the walls to strengthen them. They attached rope to bales of wool and lowered them to absorb impacts. The palace was raided of all tapestries, the elegant stitching and bright depictions of the past now draped over the walls in a desperate attempt to secure a future. By nightfall, everyone in the city was wide-eyed and trembling from the ceaseless bombardment. But they were ready. As soon as it was dark, Yestinyani sent the supplies up. At each significant breach in the wall, they put down stakes with stretches of leather hide nailed tightly between them. Into the space between the hides and the remains of the wall, they dumped stones, timber, bushes, brushwood, and bucket after bucket of dirt. A few stakes to save a city. "Will they burn?" Radu asked Cyprian as they oversaw a patch along the Bahine Palace wall. "The hides will not light easily, but we will need to station guards with crossbows to keep men away regardless." Cyprian paused to shout directions to men rolling large barrels packed with dirt toward them. "Along the top, so we have something to hide behind." The men had only just finished placing the barrels when a stone ball came sailing out from the blackness. Radu did not have time to hold his breath as he watched it smash directly into the makeshift wall. The loose materials held by the skins absorbed the cannonball's impact, and the ball rolled harmlessly to the ground. The men around them cheered. Many dropped to their knees in prayer. Cyprian whooped joyfully, throwing his arms around Radu in a hug. Radu cringed at the pain in his shoulder and at the shout of joy that had escaped his own lips before he realized he was cheering for the wrong side. The next 5 days brought no rest, no change. The cannons fired, the sound of stone shattering stone so constant Radu stopped noticing it. The acrid scent of smoke was everywhere. When he came home to sleep for a few hours, Nazira made him dump water over his hair outside to try to rinse some of it away. But as soon as sleep claimed him, the noise from the wall would jar him awake. He stopped trying to go home, instead slumping in the shadow of the inner wall for a few minutes of rest. The hours blurred, only the sun or the moon marking the passage of time. Even those were so obscured by smoke that they were hardly visible. In addition to the ceaseless bombardment, Ottoman troops threw themselves against the walls at random. They used hooks to pull down the barrels of earth protecting the defenders. The Ottomans were packed so tightly that a single shot of a small cannon could kill several. Yet still, they came. That was the part Radu wished he could block out, the axe that made him certain he could never wash the scent of the wall from his soul, because he had to be on this side, and he had to play his part. And so when the Ottoman soldiers, his brothers, ran up to try to retrieve the bodies of their compatriots, he sat on top of the wall with the enemy and picked them off, one by one. The first time he hit a man, he turned and vomited, but soon even his body was numb to the horror of what he was doing. That felt worse. With each shot he prayed he missed, and with each hit he prayed the walls would fall soon and spare them all. On the 6th day of the bombardment, an explosion cracked through the air, echoing off the walls. It was notable only because it had not come from the walls. It had come from the Ottoman camp. Radu ran to the top of the wall, leaning over. Black smoke billowed from the bank of earth that hid the basilica. The location of the cannon had been identified on the 1st day, but Giestiniani had not been able to destroy it. They had not needed to, apparently. Even from this distance, the devastation was obvious. The gun must have finally succumbed to the heat and pressure of so many firings and exploded. Radu wiped furiously at his face, his hands leaving more grit than they cleared away. He had no doubt that Urbana had accompanied Mahmed to take care of her precious artillery. Had her greatest triumph been her end? An exhausted and ragged cheer rose around him, but this time he could not even pretend to join in. The basilica was gone. The wall still held, and his friend was more than likely dead. Cyprian found him sitting with his back to the barrels, staring blankly at the city on the hill. How much more would this damnable city cost them all before the end?
Come. Giestinyani is at the Lycos River Valley section of the wall. He is guaranteed to have some food worth eating.
Cyprian led Radu down the line to the Italian. He ate the offered food in numb silence as the sun set, realizing too late that he had not even remembered to pray in his heart.
You should go rest,
Giestinyani said, his tired smile kind.
We have had a victory today, through no merit of our own. But we will take it.
Radu felt as though he could sleep for years. That was what he wanted, to fall asleep and wake up with the city already the Ottoman capital. Everything changed and settled and peaceful once more, because he still believed Constantinople should be and would be Mehmed's. The Prophet, peace be upon him, had declared it. But Radu did not want to see anything more that happened before the city fell. That was when a rhythmic pounding broke through the smoke-dimmed quiet of the night air. It was followed by the clashing of cymbals and the calls of pipes. Finally, the screams of men joined the chorus, a chilling cacophony promising death. The hair on Radu's arms stood. He had been on the other end of this tactic before, at Cruj, exhilarated to join with his brothers in a wall of noise. He had never been on the receiving end. He understood now why it was so effective, to hear what was coming and be unable to flee. Flares bloomed to life in the valley beneath them. With a wave of noise, thousands of men surged forward to crash against the wall. Radu followed Giestinyani's screamed commands. Men raced from other sections of the wall to help. Radu fired arrow after arrow, switching to a crossbow when his injured shoulder became too much. Still, the Ottomans came. Where they breached the wall, Giestinyani was waiting. At some places, the bodies were piled so high they formed steps nearly to the top. Ottomans scrambled on top of Ottomans, clawing their way to the death that waited for them. And then their bodies became stepping stones for the men behind them. Everything was smoke and darkness, screaming and drums, blood and fire. Radu stared in a daze. How could these be men? How could this be real?
Radu!
Cyprian shouted. He grabbed Radu's arm, spinning him out of range of a sword. Several Ottomans had breached the wall next to him. Radu wanted to tell them they were not enemies, but their blades were raised, and so Radu met them. Cyprian pressed his back to Radu's. A sword flashed toward Cyprian. Not Cyprian, was Radu's only thought as he hacked off the arm holding the sword. It was then that he finally saw the face of the man. He looked at Radu, all rage draining away. He looked like Petru, that stupid Yanacheri Larda kept around. He could have been, had Larda not taken them to Valahia. Then the man tipped off the edge of the wall and fell into the darkness. Radu did not have time to think, to feel, because there was another sword and another arm. These were his brothers. But in the chaos and the fury, it did not matter. It was kill or be killed. And Radu killed, and killed, and killed. Finally, the attack that had started like a wave receded like one, quietly fading back into the night. Giestinyani limped past Radu and Cyprian.
Burn the battering rams! Let them gather their dead!
Radu did not know how long it had lasted, or what it had cost them. But it was over. He did not realize he was crying until Cyprian embraced him, holding him close.
It is done. We did it. The wall stands.
Whether Radu was crying in relief or despair, he was too tired to know. He had had no choice, had he? He had kept Cyprian alive, and he had stayed alive. But it did not feel like a victory. Together they stumbled from the wall and into the city, collapsing in the shadow of a church and falling into a sleep not even the angry increase of bombardment could disturb. When Radu awoke, his head was resting against Cyprian's shoulder. A deep sense of well-being and relief flooded him. They had done it. They had made it. And then horror chased away the relief. He had fought at this man's side, rejoiced in their survival, knowing full well that every Byzantine who survived was one more Mehmed had to fight to win, knowing that every day the walls held, more of his Muslim brothers died. Where was his heart? Where was his loyalty? Radu staggered away from the still sleeping Cyprian. He wandered, dazed and in mourning, once again finding himself at the Hagia Sophia. A small boy was curled into himself, asleep at the base of the building, invisible in the midst of so much darkness. Radu walked over to Amal, his steps heavy. He leaned down and shook the boy awake. "Tell Mehmed he is firing the cannons wrong." 32. Mid-April. Lada ran to meet the solitary form of Stefan making his unhurried way through the canyon toward them. He had shaved. Facial hair had helped him blend in at the castle in Hunidwara. But out here, where only landed men could have beards, a bare face made him more invisible. "No gossip precedes us," he said. "We should make camp this afternoon, and travel the rest of the way in the morning." Lada sighed. "I would set up camp with the devil right now if it meant getting out of the cold." "I believe the devil quite likes flames." Lada started narrowing her eyes. "Stefan, did you make a joke? I did not think you knew how." His face betrayed no emotion. "I have many skills." Lada laughed. "That I already knew." The path they took followed the Argish River, retracing the route Lada had taken with her father so many summers ago. This time Bogdan rode at her side instead of in the back with the servants, and Radu was lost to her, as was her father, and any tenderness she might have held for him. Radu would survive. He would be fine. He could not die at the walls of Constantinople, because he belonged to her and she would not allow it. Just like Valahia belonged to her, and she would not allow anyone else to have it. "Why do you keep looking up at that peak?" Nikolai asked, following her line of sight. "You are making me nervous. Do you expect an attack?" Lada glared. "No." She had considered slipping out and making her way toward the ruins of the fortress on the peak. She wanted to stand at its edge, to greet the dawn and feel the warmth of her true mother, Valahia, greeting her and blessing her. But the too recent encounter with her other mother pulled at her, tearing at the edges of her certainty. What if she remembered the fortress wrong? What if she climbed up and the sun did not come out? What if it did, but it felt the same as any other sunrise? She could not risk tainting that precious memory. She clutched the locket around her neck, the one Radu had given her, to replace her old leather pouch. Inside were the dusty remains of an evergreen sprig and a flower from these same mountains. She had carried them with her as talismans through the lands of her enemies. Now she was home, and still in the land of her enemies. She would climb that peak one day soon, when it was all hers. She would come back, and she would rebuild the fortress to honor Valahia. They paused at the peak's base, refilling their canteens and watering the horses. Lada dismounted. She scrambled through the jumble of dark gray boulders, following a trickle of water that met the stream. Hidden behind the rocks was a cave. She ducked inside, where the frigid temperature dropped even lower. She could not see far, so she felt along the rough edges of the cave. But then something changed under her fingers. These were too smooth, no longer the natural shape of rocks. Someone had carved this out of the mountain, which meant it was not a cave. It was a secret passage. Lada pushed forward blindly until she hit the end. There were no other tunnels, no branches. Why make a passage that led nowhere? Had someone been cutting to the heart of the mountain, just like Vahot in the old story, only to find that mountains have no hearts? A drop of water fell on her head, and she tipped her chin up. She shouted. The sound echoed upward, disappearing into the noise of frantic bats, disturbed in their slumber. Lada flinched, but none came down to water. Which meant there was another way for them to escape.
She felt the wall again until she found handholds carved into the stone. There was only one place this tunnel could lead, straight to her ruined fortress, which meant it was a secret escape, a way to be free when all other ways were closed. Valahia always found a way. Though it was spring, bitterly cold, but still spring, Larda saw more fallow fields than ones ready for planting. The land they travelled through had an air of stagnation. Finally they reached farmland that was being used. Decrepit hovels, with smoke rising from their chimneys, dotted the edges of fields. On the horizon, the Basarab Manor soared, 2 stories and large enough to house all the peasants in all the hovels they had passed. Larda and her men made no attempt to hide their approach. Matthias had promised to send notice. If he had betrayed them, they were going to have to fight, regardless. A child sat on the side of the road. His head was too big for his rail-thin body, which was visible through his rags. It was too cold to be out in anything less than a cloak. He watched them approach, listless. Nikolai paused in front of him. "Where is your mother?" The boy blinked dully. "Your father?" When there was no response, Nikolai held out a hand. "Come with me," he said. The boy stood, and Nikolai easily lifted him onto his horse. "He is probably crawling with bugs," Petru said, frowning. "Leave him be." Nikolai gave Petru a dangerous look, all his good humor gone. "If being infested disqualified someone from our company, you would have been out years ago." Petru sat straighter in his saddle, hand going to the pommel of his sword. "I tire of being the butt of your jokes." "If you do not want to be the butt, try to be less of an ass." Petru's expression turned ferocious. Larda moved her horse between them. "If Nikolai wants to pick up strays, that is his choice." Bogdan, next to Larda, as always, nodded toward their party. "We are doing a lot of that." Behind the mounted men, straggling back for half a league, a weary but determined group of people was catching up. In addition to her 30 remaining Yanacheris, Larda had picked up more than 2 dozen young Valahian men from her time in Transylvania and Hungary. They carried staffs, pitchforks, clubs. One had a rusty scythe. None of them had horses, but they marched in as near a formation as they could manage. Larda knew those men, but behind them were the fringes of the camp, women organized by Wana to run things, men too old to fall in easily with the eager young ones. Even a man and his daughters who had followed them from Arges rather than take the dangerous roads alone. "This is absurd," Larda said. "Why do they stay with us?" Her men, she understood. They had nothing better, nowhere else to go. They were loyal to her, and to the hope that perhaps she would find them a place in the world. They were soldiers, too, used to travel and hardship. But these people, they had nothing better, nowhere else to go. They were loyal to her, and to the hope that perhaps she would find them a place in the world, too. An hour later, Larda sat in a pleasantly furnished room, drinking hot wine, and warm for the first time since her mother's stifling sitting room. Bogdan was on one side, Nikolai the other. Petru and Stefan stood at the door, casually intimidating. Against the opposite wall, Toma Bazarab's guards stood with snide confidence.
"The letter I received from Matthias Corvinus was interesting."
Toma Bazarab's hair and beard were silver. He wore velvet and silk as dark as his wine, his buttons shining silver beacons that matched his hair.
"I want to be prince," Larda said.
Toma Bazarab laughed, his mirth as bright as his buttons.
"Why would you want that?"
"Our princes fail Valahia. They are too busy appealing to foreign powers, pandering to boyars, desperately going over their own coffers. Meanwhile, our country rots around them." "I will change that." Toma leaned back, tapping his fingers on his glass.
"The system is what it is. It has worked for this long."
"Worked for whom?"
"I know you have big dreams, little Draculesht.
But Valahia is as Valahia was.